Welcome, everyone. I will call the remote meeting of the Local Government Division to order. Today is February 23rd, 2022. This meeting is being held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which allows for remote hearing. The meetings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take the attendance, please.
Good morning. Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Byrd.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Mecklen.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Joachim. Representative Joachim. All the representative Joachim are present.
Thank you very much. The next item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for February 16th. Representative Quam, have you read the minutes?
I would so move to approve.
Thank you. Is there any discussion or corrections? Okay. If everyone would unmute, please. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes stand approved as written. Thank you so much. Our first and only bill today is House File 3256. It's the bill that I know Representative Elkins has worked really hard on and has generated a lot of interest. So with all the interest that has been generated, we're going to try to make allowances so that everyone will have a chance to weigh in. And before we start with the testimony, Representative Elkins, did you want to say a few words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we're going to start out the hearing with a collection of presentations from an all-star list of experts in the area of housing, economics, and demographics, the trends. So even before I walk through the bill, we have Danielle Leach from Zonda, Luke Bell from Zillow, and Libby Starling from the Minneapolis Fed, and they're going to be reprising presentations that they made before the Legislative Commission on Housing Affordability back in October. They'll be joined following them by Dave Arbit from the Minneapolis Area Realtors, who has this amazing database of home listing information, home sale information in the Twin Cities. And Salim First from the Mercatus Center. And Salim is the one who did a lot of the number crunching, the analysis that supported Mary Jo Webster's story in the Strib last summer. And so he's got some very valuable insights as well about the local market. So both Dave and Salim will be talking somewhat about Minnesota market conditions, especially the Twin Cities. And I should mention in advance that at least a few of these presenters, Danielle Leach is going to go first, and Libby Starling are presenting, presenting information. They're not taking a position on the bill at all, and their positions won't allow them to do that. So they will not actually be testifying for or against the bill or talking to any particular provisions in the bill.
Okay,
and then after that, they're kind of set the table, then I will lay out the bill itself.
Thank you. Ms. Leach, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record, and proceed.
Hello.
And welcome.
I am Danielle Leach from Zonda. Let me go ahead and share my screen. I assume you all can see that okay?
Yep. Yes.
Okay, just a little bit about the type of data that I'm going to show you today. Zonda, we have our own proprietary information on the Twin Cities market. We collect sales data from builders in a local market. We also have boots on the ground where we do observation, meaning we come in, we count starts, we count observed closings, meaning we can tell people are actually occupying the home. And then we also count vacant developed lots and all types of lot activity. So that I'll be showing you our data today. So kind of to set the stage, I know David's going to go through this information later on, but I want to at least kind of tie it into our data as well. First and foremost, all types of housing is extremely tight right now in the Twin Cities in terms of inventory. The resale inventory is extremely tight at 0.6 months of supply. So to give you context, we would typically expect 4 months, five at the most there in a balanced market. So to have less than 1 month supply running extremely tight. So with all of the really strong demand that we have out there, coupled with that limited inventory, we've seen a pretty significant uptick in that median resale price. So up 8.5% year over year, and that's at that $320,000 price tag. All right, so kind of switching into our proprietary data. We have builders in the market that are reacting to all that very strong demand. They've been pushing hard on starts, which are, you can tell in that graph there, that starts are really outpacing closings. That's not a reflection of a lack of demand in the market. It's simply that builders are selling inventory faster than they can even get it started or even get it closed. A lot of that has to do with the supply shortages that you're hearing about, also labor shortages. So there's a little bit of a gap there, but all indicative of extremely strong demand, up 29% year over year on starts. It's huge, huge growth year over year. And what's interesting in the Twin Cities is that we've seen substantial growth on the townhome side. So builders are really trying to capture what we would call like that entry level first time buyer type of demand with attainably priced product. I would say it's still priced very high. We're also going after luxury buyers in prime locations here. But you can just see over the last year or two, huge growth on townhome units. In particular, year over year, up 60%. And there are a lot of units under construction right now, as well as lot development in the pipeline. So we'll continue to see townhomes grow. When we compare year over year starts for the last 3 years and the purple little triangle or diamond that you're seeing there, that's telling you the year over year change, huge growth in that $450,000 priced up. So here you're looking at volume of starts, and this is for the product where it's base priced, so not including options and upgrades. I will call to attention that $500,000 to $749,000 price range, 124% year over year growth and starts activity there. I'll also point out just how little product there is priced under $350,000, and that starts are actually declining there year over year in each of those buckets. In particular, anything under $250,000. Here, I'm showing you just the comparison year over year of where volume has shifted in each of those same price buckets, base prices here, but this is based on contracts. So the number of contracts comparing year over year and that volume change. So you can just see a huge swing to a product being sold $450,000 on up and just a pretty dramatic decline in anything priced under $450,000. Now keep in mind, this is a reaction to the product that's available there and only looking at a time period of year over year. But even with that, you can just see the huge shift in terms of just the lack of product under $450,000. Again, I'll keep reminding you, this is base prices. We've watched that bar, that under $250,000 there, decline year over year over year with huge volume there to the point that we've got just very little product available in the Twin Cities there. To give you a sense, again, these are base prices, but here we're looking at the market share of closings, annual closings. And I'm just showing you a four-year time span here to give you a sense of just how much this product has shifted in the market in a really, really small, narrow amount of time. In particular, look at that 500 to 749,000. That's that orange bar that you just see, that line just kind of spike up. It's now 25% of the market share. It was product base priced 500 to 749,000. That was around 13% just 4 years ago. So you can see in the blue lines, just noticing that they're heading down. So losing share, while much more expensive product is quickly gaining share. Switching gears a little bit and looking at the pipeline. The pipeline tells us what's coming at us, looking at the lots that builders have delivered over the last year. In 2021, they largely kept pace with starts, but I'll show you volume of starts coming in, it will be much more expensive product. So looking at all of the vacant developed lot inventory that's in the market, I would tell you it's running tight in the Twin Cities at 14.8 months of supply. We would expect 24 months of supply there in a balanced market. So not enough really like vacant developed lots there. And you need the lots in order to do the starts, which turn into closings. So you have to, I always call it feed the beast. You have to have lots coming into the market to maintain the housing that you need and to see growth. So if I take those vacant developed lots that are available right now and looked at what our estimated base pricing is for the product that will be eventually built on that lot, you know, you continue to see really huge growth in that 450 to that 750,000. Volume growth there, in this particular year-over-year growth from last year, from 2020 into 2021. But I'll also look at that under 400,000. Continuing to see declines there, which means we will continue to see starts and closings further decline in those price back buckets. Just a couple of more points as I wrap up. This is the same story that we see throughout the United States, and Twin Cities is no different. Projects are selling out at a much faster rate than communities are being opened. So generally less product available out there, and in the Twin Cities, significantly more expensive year over year. So everybody always asks me for my projections. I have them relatively flat looking at 2022 in terms of starts, just a 1% growth. We have a lot of headwinds and tailwinds coming at builders right now. The demand is certainly there, but I'm sure you all are watching the mortgage rates just like I do. An uptick in mortgage rates really pulls that many buyers, especially our entry-level buyers. They're getting priced out of the market. So we're kind of decreasing the demand pool with those rising mortgage rates. At the same time, land costs are much more expensive. Supplies are skyrocketing, especially lumber, and labor is going up as well. So the demand is there. We're just going to have a harder time getting to that demand. And with that, I will pass it on to the next speaker.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bell, again, would you identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. I am Luke Bell. I manage government relations and public affairs in the Midwest for Zillow, which is the world's most visited real estate website. We're about 230 million customers a month look to buy, sell, rent, or finance their next home. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Considering the number of conferees that are going to be speaking on the bill, I will obviously be very brief, and I'll move quickly through my comments this morning. I have also filed written testimony with the committee, so a lot of the information I'm going to discuss can be found there in much more detail. First of all, I just want to express our appreciation to Representative Elkins for bringing together this massive effort to put together this legislation, along the way consulting with dozens of stakeholders who all have their own thoughts and opinions as to how to tackle this housing crisis. But we just want to commend him for undertaking this effort. But a major part of what we do at Zillow, we are obviously interested in reducing barriers to housing. So my comments today are going to touch on, I think, a little bit more of a unique perspective on this, which is the equity challenges that are created by the affordability crisis we have right now. So as part of this commitment, our team of economists examine housing market data and economic trends, and we try to share this research and data to help inform policymakers as you work through these housing issues. I know the realtors are going to be speaking a lot more to inventory, so I'm just going to barely touch on that. But just to set the table, 2021 was an unprecedented year for housing demand, coupled with a historic inventory shortage. When we look at the Zillow Home Value Index, home values in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region appreciated by 43% in the last 5 years, 12% in the last year alone. We expect home values will continue to climb in 2022, increasing by roughly 16% nationally by the end of the year compared to the end of 2021. Unfortunately, this housing affordability crisis perpetuates some extreme economic and racial inequalities in Minnesota's largest communities. Specifically in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region, the Black home ownership rate is currently just 26%. Compared to the white home ownership rate of 76%. I want to emphasize this point because this is the lowest Black home ownership rate in the entire nation out of the 59 major metropolitan areas we studied for this research report. It is also the largest gap in the nation between the Black home ownership rate and the white home ownership rate. And we believe this is largely a result of these missing middle housing opportunities, which I will elaborate in more detail, which this bill would help create. So according to our research, reforming residential zoning rules, even modestly, to allow for more housing construction and more density would be the most effective way to increase housing supply and also increase housing affordability. So unfortunately, Minnesota has experienced a massive shortfall in housing construction over the last decade plus. Although the new numbers are encouraging and building is picking up, it is still lacking compared to historically what should have been built under normal conditions. If building permits had been issued at historic rates over the last 12 years, there would have been over 40,000 additional new housing units constructed just in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. So we polled housing experts as part of this research, and not surprisingly, we found that relaxing zoning rules to allow for more efficient new home construction, including more density, would be the most effective way to increase housing supply. What's more, we have found there is broad public support for these measures. We did a survey in 2019, and we found that 57% of respondents in Minneapolis-St. Paul support constructing additional housing units through more density in their communities. So thankfully, we believe that fairly modest and fairly straightforward zoning updates can be achieved without drastically changing the character of existing neighborhoods. So according to our research, out of 17 major metropolitan areas we studied, the Minneapolis-St. Paul region has the fifth highest proportion of housing units that were zoned exclusively for single family use, which is basically 74% of the housing stock in the region. This is really high. Minneapolis-St. Paul also had the lowest number of housing units that are located in 2 to 49 unit structures. This is what we call the missing middle. That's only 16% of the housing stock in Minneapolis. Not surprisingly, according to our research, neighborhoods that are made up of mostly single-family detached homes are whiter, and they are more racially segregated than units that have a better mix of housing units. So in Minneapolis-St. Paul, while 76% of the population is white, the average neighborhood of single-family detached homes is over 87% white. Under the status quo, we estimate that Minneapolis-St. Paul will only add a little bit more than 380,000 housing units over the next two decades. The Metropolitan Council projects that the area's population will grow by 560,000 over the same time period. So if Minneapolis-St. Paul doesn't build more housing, not only will we not chip away at the current lack of inventory, we also won't keep up with population growth and build enough housing to meet population growth needs. According to our research, even by making relatively small changes to local zoning rules, such as allowing duplexes to be built on only one out of every 10 currently single-family zoned lots, the region could add an additional 115,000 new housing units over the next 20 years. This is a 30% improvement over the status quo. allowing 4 housing units to be constructed, again, on just 1 out of every 10 single-family zone lots, that's only 10% of the single-family zone lots, could add 345,000 new housing units over the next 20 years, which is a 91% improvement over the status quo. And I just want to close by emphasizing the status quo, in our opinion, is likely to produce new housing units, mostly in single-family homes and units in large apartment buildings. It will not create the missing middle, those 2 to 4 unit buildings that we believe will be more affordable for groups that have been left out of housing in the current environment. Homes in duplexes, triplexes, and small to medium-sized multifamily buildings are more affordable and therefore likely more accessible for groups that have traditionally not had the household savings and the access to intergenerational wealth to buy a single family detached home. So we believe that reforming zoning laws to allow for more multifamily housing would be a major step forward in addressing the clear housing inequalities we see in the state of Minnesota and the Minneapolis-St. Paul region specifically. So we commend Representative Elkins for this effort. Madam Chair, we thank the committee for taking the bill up, and we appreciate the opportunity to provide comments and would love to stand for questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you very much. Will you be available for questions later on if I take questions at the end?
Absolutely. I'll be here for the entire meeting.
Okay, terrific.
Madam Chair?
I do see
your hand. Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Quam? I see
your
hand.
Thank you. There's a lot of talk from this testifier on data. It'd be nice to see the unaggregated data on Minnesota because the vast majority of his negative aspects were underneath the auspices of 2 cities within the state of Minnesota. And frankly, I think that might be caused by specific issues with those 2 cities, and cities of the first class are treated differently. And I think that going into the details would be useful. So if we can get that data offline, it'll give us some very good talking on future meetings. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments, and I hope our testifiers have heard that. Before we proceed, first of all, Representative Joachim has joined us, and I do want to mention that the agenda and a lot of the written testimony is on the local government website. For those that don't already have the information. And again, as people proceed, we've got a lot of testifiers. Please try to be as concise and brief as possible. And next we have Ms. Starling. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, all. My name is Libby Starling, and I'm a director in the Community Development and Engagement Division of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And my comments will in some ways mirror those of Mr. Bell, though we did not coordinate. So I'd like to talk to the committee this morning about challenges and opportunities to housing affordability in the Twin Cities area, focusing on 3 areas: the lack of new housing overall, the lack of new affordable housing, and similar to Mr. Bell, looking at low homeownership rates among communities of color. I will note the disclaimer at the bottom of the slide that the views expressed here are mine and mine alone and do not represent the Federal Reserve or the Federal Reserve System. So looking at the lack of new housing, you've heard from the previous testifiers about challenges in the ownership market, but more broadly, the Twin Cities is seeing overall low vacancy rates across both for sale housing and rental housing. So according to data looking at the 2020 census, 4.6% of all housing was vacant in 2020, and this made the Twin Cities metropolitan area have the lowest vacancy rate of any of the largest 56 largest metro areas in the country. So when we have the sense that housing is in scarce supply, there is data that backs up the feeling and the sensation that we're seeing as prices increase. So this is the result of a decade-long trend of new housing starts. So looking at both rental housing and owner-occupied housing, not keeping up with what is really the demand. Now, when we look at the estimated need for new units, I have put a line on the slide before you. That's an estimated need. It's falling over time as population growth is slowing down, looking at data from the Metropolitan Council. But I think we can agree that the overall need of new units being built in the Twin Cities is somewhere in the 20,000 to 15,000. The Metropolitan Council estimated about 18,000 units a few years ago. So that's how many new units we need. The colors on the chart before you are looking at new housing starts. So the building permits that were pulled for new single family detached, new townhomes, and new multifamily of 5 units or more, as well as the very small number of duplexes, triplexes, and quads. So the first thing that you see is that in the Great Recession, we see a large white area under the line of estimated need for new units when housing construction collapsed in the Great Recession earlier. In the last 4 years or so, the number of new building permits pulled has increased over what we might assume is the estimated need. And we're happy, we're proud that housing starts are over 20,000 for the last year or two, but it doesn't make up for the loss in new housing that we saw between 2006 and 2016. So looking back at that decade of lost housing starts. So I'd like to ask you to do a thought experiment. So as we look at the excess production that we're seeing right now, how much of that is filling the hole that we've seen? So taking the amount that's above the need, moving it back in time, and how much is it filling in? And here we see that we filled in maybe 4 years of lost construction, and we still have this huge white area where new housing starts were not sufficient to meet the need. So a rough calculation is that we're behind by about 80,000 missing units that were not built over the last 15 years to keep up with housing demand. So with fewer units being added in the market, we see the increased competition on existing homes. We see high demand, as we heard from the previous presenter, for existing units, as we simply don't have enough to keep up with demand. We see the similar patterns as well when we look at new affordable housing, so housing built at lower price points. The Metropolitan Council keeps track of new housing units built at various levels of affordability, from 30% of area median income, 31 to 50, 51 to 60. And here there's an orange line, because the Metropolitan Council in the last decade set a goal measuring the need for new affordable units in the 7-county area, up to 60% of area median income. When we look at the actual, and they set that need at 51,000 units for 60%. But if we look at the area that hasn't been met over that time, we see that looking at the more affordably priced points, there are 35,000 missing affordable units to meet the last decade's affordable need. So these are households who are earning lower incomes who are not able to find affordable housing opportunities that meet their household needs. And then the final trend I want to pull up is low homeownership rates among households of color. So we already heard from Mr. Bell, and here I've jumped to statewide data, that the state has one of the highest homeownership rates across the country, highest homeownership rates for white households, but one of the largest gaps between the homeownership rate for white households and the homeownership rate in particular among Black households. But when we go back in time, we see that our region actually had the highest Black homeownership rate back in 1950, when nearly half of all Black households in the state were homeowners. So when we think about what was happening for Black households in the 1950s, it doesn't necessarily feel like an idyllic time, but that was the point in history where Black homeownership reached its high point. So as we think about what the various trends are that have combined to create in particular, the very, very low Black homeownership rate in Twin Cities and in the state as a whole, thinking about what has changed since the 1950s to lead to these low homeownership rates. So I've pulled together three different pieces, looking at the lack of new housing, the lack of new affordable housing, and the lack of homeownership rates. But they may all be connected. We know that communities of color in Minnesota do lag white households in the amount of income and certainly the level of wealth that they have been able to put into homeownership. So what aspect of the low homeownership rates are resulting from the lack of new housing that we've seen, particularly over the last 15 years, as well as the lack of new affordable housing, and how all of these trends are coming together to create low homeownership rates and limiting opportunities for long-term wealth building among our communities of color. And with that, I thank you for your time this morning.
Representative Mason, you're muted.
Are you able to stay with us for the rest of the meeting?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you very much. Next, Mr. Arbut, if you would identify yourself and proceed, please. Mr. Arbut?
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
And thanks for having us this morning. It's an honor to be here talking about such an important topic with you all. Also want to give a shout out to fellow presenters. Already great content presented that I really think sets the stage and illustrates the need and the challenges that we're all feeling in this space. So with that, I'd like to share a few data points that we're watching as it pertains to the topics here. So let me get my share started here. Okay, so we are here to talk about the market. So I'm gonna try to keep this as brief as possible. DIRT, let's start with DIRT. Fundamental kind of underlies everything. Not a lot of lot sales, right? So this goes back to beginning of last year, just kind of tracking lot sales activity. I wanna give a caveat just right off the top. If it's listed on MLS, we can see it. If it's an off MLS deal, we can't. So we know we've got a good representative sample, but we know that we don't have an exhaustive list. It's not all activity. So you guys can see where activity sort of peaks for the year, you know, heading in, you know, April, May, spring market, not surprising. I think this is a little bit more interesting looking back historically, going back to 04. What I like about this is that it kind of shows the Great Recession and the mortgage and foreclosure crisis. And we see lot sales plummet from 800 down to 300. It looks like the pendulum overswung center a little bit, but then we settled into, you know, a level between say 700 and 800 that's just insufficient in light of current demand. Nice to see a little bit of a increase here, but still it's just not sufficient to fuel or to supply the current demand, particularly in the more affordable price brackets. That's a lot for a lot, right? This is median price per acre. Representative Elkins and I were looking at this over kind of late last year. So we see that the price of an acre in the 7-county metro has gotten to just about 200K. So that's 50 grand for a quarter acre, 66 or 70 or so for a third, and you guys can do the math from there. So yes, this has been on the rise significantly. So even to, you know, 2010, we saw some increases here. Little bit of a decline here, followed by 2 years of notable increases in the cost of DIRT. Just thinking about new construction market share, right? Used to be about 15% of our market. That was when we were building a lot of condos. So a lot of our condos were new. And then look at what happened with new construction. We fell to 6%. We've sort of clawed our way back to 10%, although all the challenges and supply chain issues we've seen over the last couple of years, lots, labor, lending, lumber, and laws, you know, have kind of capped some growth here, unfortunately. Just looking at prices overall before I break it out, last year, prices in the metro rose about 11.5%. to 340,000. You guys can see how that compares to bubble levels, and you can see the rate of growth since 2011, 2012 here. Okay, so let's dive in. Let's sort of slice and dice the data a little bit more, looking at new listings of newly constructed homes. So when a builder lists a home, this is a listing of a newly built home, and we've broken it out by price point. In blue, 300K and under, and then in red, 300K and up. Pretty clear to see, builders used to list 300K and under homes. And then you can kind of see where things switched in 2012, and suddenly 300K kind of became the dominant force in the market. Now, some of this, right, there's a lot of factors causing this. Some of it is just appreciation. A home that would have been listed at 290 a couple years later will be listed at 310. So in some ways, you know, homes and products sort of age out of some of these price brackets. But in other ways, right, like the five L's we talked about, lots, labor, lending, lumber, and laws have really, again, put a cap on some of this activity. Sales, I won't speak too much to this. Just know that listings and sales really kind of follow one another. Okay, how about the price of new versus existing? Just a few more. New construction homes cost about 450K in our market. Existing or previously owned units cost about 330K in our market. Faster rate of price growth for existing versus new because of the affordability piece, right? Because of that affordability piece. Briefly looking at absorption rates by price range. So this speaks to just how little supply we have relative to demand. A healthy absorption rate is about 4, 5, or 6 months of supply. We have 1 month and about half a month of supply. So we are so far from what would be called a balanced market. We are so dramatically undersupplied that you know, a half a month of supply, 2/3 of a month of supply, that's 2 or 3 weeks of supply. We need 4 or 5 months of supply. You can see it's the tighter market. The under 300K market is tighter than the 300K and over market. However, both segments are what we classify as extreme seller's markets, pretty extreme seller's markets. Even if I go up to 350, you know, the data changes a little bit, but the pattern, the trend is the same. Days on market, what's selling more quickly? 27 days for homes under 300 versus 28 days. So that's not a big difference, but look at the change over time, right? 65 to 52 versus 37 to 32. So some important data points there. Last couple here, looking at percent of original list price received. Sellers of units under 350 were realizing 101.5% of their list price. You got that right, 100% plus 1.5%. Over 350 was just about 101%, just under 101. So not a huge difference, but a difference. Inventory overall, we once had 30,000 active homes for sale in our market. We ended last month with 4,300. This is a snapshot of the properties that are for sale, right, in active for sale status at month end. This picture really kind of highlights the challenges that we're facing, and that whether you're in the Twin Cities or many of our greater Minnesota beautiful communities, this is a challenge affecting Minnesotans across our state. Month supply, I won't spend a lot of time here. Just know that we've gotten from 9 months of supply down to 0.8 overall. So that really shows a similar trend with inventory, but this way framed kind of as an absorption rate. And then last couple here, change in new listings by price range. So this one's really important. So overall, we fell about 1% in terms of seller activity, right? Last year, or excuse me, 2020 to 2021. However, we had almost 25% growth in listing of units between 500,000 and 750,000, while we had 30% fewer listings between 150 and roughly 200K, 150 to about 190. So we can kind of see a tale of two markets where you have the over 350 segment and the sort of under 350 segment where we're not seeing new supply coming on. We are seeing new supply coming on, you know, at 350, 5 to 8, 750 up to a million and a million plus. But we're not seeing adequate levels of new supply coming on in the more affordable ranges. Because that's what is coming on the market, that's mostly what's flowing off the market. So that's where we see our gains, right? Change in closed sales, look at a million plus, 50% increase in million plus sales. Now, while perhaps there's more need on this end of the spectrum, I want to say that maybe this isn't a bad thing, right? If we don't adequately supply, that luxury market, some of those folks are going to be competing with in cash with folks in maybe more of these middle market tiers. So there's, nothing bad about this. It's just that we need to see more supply across the spectrum. It's really across the whole price spectrum. Last slide, here's million plus, just kind of illustrating just what's happened there. And we see that 50% plus in this luxury end of the market. Again, the market is a spectrum. We need opportunities under 300K and we need opportunities over a million. One of those ends of the spectrum is performing, adequately well, and the other is not. So I think that's where the challenges kind of lie. And with that, I will stop. And any brief questions I can entertain. I do have to run, unfortunately, but happy to hop back on or follow up with you or any staff.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
And next, Mr.
Firth. Madam Chair, just real quick before Mr. Firth starts, back to Representative Quam's point, I think in the case of all of the presenters, they're referring to data for the entire metropolitan statistical area, or at least the 7-county metro. So when the term Twin Cities is being used here, it doesn't mean Minneapolis and St. Paul the cities. It means the whole region.
Okay, thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair.
And okay,
Madam Chair.
I hear you, Ms. Representative Quam. Okay, you have a comment?
Yes. The one testifier repeatedly, specifically stated Minneapolis in many of his points, and repeatedly stated St. Paul and Minneapolis. Therefore, his presentation was presented predominantly with points with those two cities. Now, there were other comments, and so the author either is telling us that testifier was inaccurate and saying incorrect things or misinterpreting what was actually said in committee.
Okay. I think those comments were
Representative Elkins
by Mr. Bell, Madam Chair, and maybe he can answer that question directly.
Mr. Bell, are you still available?
Yes, Madam Chair, I appreciate it. In the interest of brevity, I shortened, obviously. All of our research is the 11-county metropolitan statistical area. So when we say Minneapolis, St. Paul, we mean the MSA. In the interest of time, I didn't want to repeat MSA or metropolitan statistical area repeatedly. Thank you for the opportunity.
Madam Chair.
Representative Quam.
So there was no separate information on Minneapolis or St. Paul. You're saying the entire 11 county, or is 11 or 7? Because it's used differently, but that entire area is the worst in the entire nation. Am I understanding your clarification correctly?
Mr. Bell, did you want to take that?
Yes, Madam Chair. It is the entire metropolitan statistical area for all of the statistics cited in my testimony, the entire area.
Madam Chair, I wanted clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted clarification because we sometimes have 7, we sometimes have 11, and metropolitan area is not specific enough to clarify that point.
Okay. Point well taken. Thank you. Mr. First, are you ready to proceed? I think I saw your slides. Again, identify yourself first for the record.
Thank you. Are you able to see my slides now? Oh, I'm sorry. You're muted.
Right now we are seeing just you.
Okay. Let me share my screen. There we go. There we go. Thank you so much. My name is Salim Firth, and I study land use regulation and housing markets at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Mercatus is dedicated to applying market-oriented academic ideas to to real-world problems. Today, I'm going to discuss the rights and responsibilities of the state and its localities as they pertain to regulatory power. And for Representative Quam, the data I'm using cover the Metropolitan Urban Service Area, which is a subset of the seven-county metro. The exercise of local land use authority relies on institutions designed by the state. Thus, the state legislature has the responsibility of adjusting institutions that are working poorly for citizens, markets, or local governments. Mounting evidence suggests that the institutions of development in suburban Minnesota are broken. An increasing number of suburbs are abandoning traditional zoning in favor of over-reliance on planned unit developments, or PUDs. There we go. PUDs are appropriate for unique or innovative projects, but they are an invitation to opaque policymaking and favoritism. In addition, the creation of a PUD agreement involves upfront administrative costs, making it uneconomical for small-scale builders. When PUDs are used for routine subdivisions, I take that as a warning sign that some aspect of the development process is not working as it should. This table shows the warning sign. In Chaska, 97% of houses built in the 2010s were in PUDs. At least 9 in 10 new homes in Maple Grove, Carver, Blaine, and Victoria are in a PUD as well. Across all metro suburbs, about half of 2010's houses are in PUDs. Lost my place. There we go. It appears that the over-reliance on PUDs occurred because local governments cannot, using the fiscal tools the state has allowed them, make new development pay for itself. Instead, localities impose uneconomical zoning to force builders into PUD negotiations. In addition, Minnesota suburbs, like many local governments nationwide, use zoning to curate which types of people can move to town. This is an inappropriate use of government power, and it tramples on property rights and fair housing principles. To address these interrelated problems, HF 3256 proposes to empower local governments fiscally in exchange for limits on their ability to force developers into using PUDs, either as an explicit requirement or by setting minimum lot size uneconomically high so that land value can only be unlocked via a PUD. That brings us to this slide on minimum lot sizes, which are the most universal form of land use regulation in the United States. In the metro, about 43% of houses built in the 2010s were on lots very close to or significantly smaller than the published minimum lot size. This table shows the 10 metro area cities with the highest share of newly built houses on lots that are either near or smaller than the minimum lot size. For example, in St. Paul, 59% of new homes are on lots very close to the legislated minimum. On the flip side, Forest Lake allows about half of its new houses on lots that are non-compliant, smaller than the minimum. In both cases, the data show there is strong demand for lots smaller than the legislative minimums. For context, the median minimum lot sizes in the eight suburbs in this table imply about 3 to 5 homes per acre, in case you don't carry the number of square feet in an acre around in your head like I do. Now, the additional cost of land from these minimum lot sizes can be substantial. Suppose a city's minimum lot size forces buyers to consume 1,000 square feet more of land than they would have done in a free market otherwise. That would increase the cost of a home by about $10,000 in most jurisdictions, but it's up to $29,000 in Edina. If smaller lots enable builders to provide smaller homes, the savings could be much greater. In conclusion, land use authority is not a purely local prerogative. It takes place within an institutional framework defined and regularly adjusted by the state. When warning signs emerge, such as the dominance of PUD regulation in growing metropolitan suburbs, the legislature should consider adjustments to those institutions to ensure that local land use authority can be used in ways that are fair, protect property rights, and serve the interests of Minnesotans. Thank you, and I'm available now or later for questions.
Madam Chair, you're muted.
I'm sorry. Members, we're now done with the testifiers, the first group of testifiers, and Representative Elkins, I'm just wondering if you can go through your bill quickly, or I would like to get the testifiers all done today. So should I, is it better to proceed with the testifiers first before you make your explanation? And Representative Hewitt?
No, sorry.
I see that you have a question. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Elkins first, and then...
I was having trouble finding the mute buttons because I was looking to pull up my slides, but if you want to take Representative Hewitt's question, that's fine.
Okay, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quickly, Mr. Firth, the history of PUDs, have they been around for a long time? And then the follow-up would be, if they have, what have you seen as any positive or negative outcome 10, 20 years down the line? Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a great question. So PUDs originated, I think, in the early 60s as a way to do what we now call cluster development. I think PUDs are great if you're doing something innovative, if you're building a stadium or a lifestyle center where you are really doing something that's outside the norm of how development is done in your city or your suburb. So they're a really good tool that we should keep in the toolbox. It's that when regular zoning is basically abandoned, then you've got the kind of the just discretionary developer by developer, what are you going to give the city? And, you know, can we get a seat at the negotiating table to micromanage how you're doing your development, or maybe make sure that you contribute to all the right charities or political campaigns? And that's where I'm worried that it's going off the rails. Minnesota might be the most extreme case. There's no data on this nationally, but it's certainly PUDs are a rising trend all over the country. In terms of long-run outcomes, in early research that I've done in the Twin Cities area, we're seeing that PUDs have more racial integration than single-family zoning, which is probably because smaller homes and multifamily dwellings are built alongside single-family homes. So it can certainly be a positive in terms of enabling smaller home sizes, but that's only because the single family zoning is kind of the baseline and that's quite restrictive. So it's not that they're the worst thing in the world, it's that that's not how the system is intended to function. I wouldn't just close down PUDs and leave everything else the way it was.
Response, Representative Hewitt?
I'm sure that answered it, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Elkins.
I'm ready to go, Madam Chair. So I can.
Okay. Proceed then.
Oops. Oh, wait a minute. I thought I was ready to go. I need to share my screen and I hit the wrong button. Here we go. Okay. Is that on the screen now?
Yes.
Okay. I will go through this as quickly as I can. 3 years ago, it seems like it was yesterday, I had an op-ed published in the Star Tribune that was entitled The Twin Cities Housing, the Flaming Hoop Separating Builders and Cities. And that was actually the name that J.D. Tice gave the story. But the basic premise of the story is that because cities are not currently allowed to assess cost-based development impact fees to recover their infrastructure costs directly, they are instead using a variety of other fees and zoning restrictions to slow development and recover their costs indirectly. And the testimony from Mr. Firth is a perfect example of that. My proposition, I think that one of the main reasons that cities are become so over-reliant on using the plan unit development process is because Minnesota does not allow cities to assess impact fees to cover the cost of the infrastructure needed to serve their developments. Cities are instead resorting to the PUD process to collect backdoor fees by negotiating them, by throwing the zoning out the window. And because of that, because it adds time to the process, adds expenses, Cities are just not making land available for new lots, new dirt, as Mr. Harbutt puts it, fast enough in order to allow the development community to supply the needed lots to the housing market. So the basic premise behind my bill is that you know, all development should pay its own way, but not anymore. It's unrealistic to expect that existing taxpayers are going to you know, have their property taxes increased in order to pay the infrastructure cost for new development. By the same token, cities should not be using the development process as any kind of a profit center. Most of the zoning should be by right. If a developer is able to produce a housing development proposal that is consistent with the city's basic zoning, then it ought to be approved. That's the way the zoning process is supposed to work. And when Mr. Firth says that the over-reliance on PUDs is an indication that the process is broken, it was spot on. The process is broken when you see the kind of percentages of new housing development in developing suburbs that is being done under the PUD process. It's clear indication that the process is broken. So we need a process, a reform process, that results in a housing pipeline which is providing enough new and relatively affordable workforce housing to provide shelter to every family in our growing region. So I mentioned that the current legal framework. So Minnesota is what's called a Dillon's Rule state, which means that cities have the authorities granted to them by the state. So in Minnesota, the zoning and planning authorities granted to cities are described mostly in two chapters of state law. There's chapter 462, which governs cities' zoning authorities statewide. And then there is also chapter 473, which is sometimes referred to as the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, which is an overlay of provisions that are just for cities in the 7-county metro area, that also describe the relationship of cities and counties to the Metropolitan Council. These chapters of state law were last reformed in 1995. And it was in 1995 that zoning was permanently subordinated to the comprehensive plan. The way to look at it is under the current 1995 regime, the comp plan is like the Constitution and zoning is like the laws. While I frequently hear this opinion expressed, there is not, in fact, any legal basis in the current statutes for the notion that the comp plan is the future while the zoning is now. I think that the absence of a kind of any kind of treatment, explicit treatment of the kind of the temporal dimension of zoning and planning, the orderly and staged development making sure that the infrastructure keeps up with that the cities are able to provide, keeps up with the demand for housing, is something that's actually a gap in these current laws. One that I want to address, and you know, one of the reasons I want to have the bill laid over, is that I do want to do further work on that part of the issue. So in terms of the bill itself, it's broken out into about 10 articles. The first one, it just simply allows impact fees to be used in an open and transparent and well-fenced way, like it is used in 29 other states around the country, including Wisconsin and Illinois, to ensure that cities have a mechanism to require that development pay its own way, but no more. So with an impact fee, you establish a district of benefited properties whose value will be increased by the provision of that infrastructure, enabling the development of the land. But the fund would have defined boundaries. The projects that would be funded from that district would have to be described in the city's comprehensive plan and capital improvement program. And the funds collected could only be used on those projects. Article 2 is related to that, but it's similar to that, but it's intended for use more in redeveloping areas that are developing at higher densities. So in this case, again, you'd create a district of benefiting properties. which would be in this case, it would be in a redeveloping area where there are existing land uses that may be intensifying, say a new big box store going into an area generating a ton of new traffic. And so in this district, instead of doing it on land area or land value, you would do it on the basis of actual traffic counts using actual data that is now collected as anonymized, fully private. But the same thing, the funds that would be collected from in these districts would be put into a special fund, fenced, and could only be used for the specified improvements described in the comp plan and capital improvement program for projects in those specific areas. The third and fourth articles are really kind of the meat of this. So we're talking about things that we're trying to reinstate the intent of the 1995 reform. So again, in 1995 is when the legislature, our predecessors, established that the comp plan would govern over the zoning. That is essentially the comp plan would be the constitution and the zoning would be the statutes. But there's never been any definition in those statutes for what that means. And so those provisions have largely and increasingly been ignored. So in the bill, I provided a standard definition for when zoning is conformed with the comp plan based strictly on general uses and densities, and allowing that in commercial areas, the uses may be more specific in the zoning than in the comp plan, so that cities have the ability to regulate that not only is this district commercial, but this is where the pawn shops are going to go, this is where the liquor stores are going to go, and et cetera. The intention of the zoning isn't to set the use and the density. The zoning, the use and the density in the zoning should be consistent with the comp plan, but the zoning is where you fill in the detailed performance standards designed to protect the public health, safety, and welfare. So this is where you put in things like the setback requirements, impervious surface coverages as part of your stormwater runoff program. All of those other kinds of things that we think of in addition to the lot size, the things that are in the zoning to preserve the public health, safety, and welfare. Those are the things that belong in the zoning. So next, the bill provides that where there are non-conformities between the zoning and the comp plan, the inconsistencies have to be resolved by conforming the zoning to the comp plan, which the 1995 authors intended, upon receipt of a development application and not vice versa. One of the things that I saw during my 8 years on the Met Council is that a city would guide land for multifamily housing, for example, but not follow through with the zoning. And then when a developer would work in good faith with city staff to bring forward a proposal for a multifamily housing project, the city would say, oh, wait a minute, we're turning down the zoning and we're going to resolve the discrepancy by changing the comp plan. That was not what the 1995 authors envisioned, and this clarifies that in those cases, you have to resolve the consistency by changing the zoning, not by changing the comp plan. There's a provision that would prevent retroactive moratoria. Building moratoria would not be allowed. There was one case in the Twin Cities about a year or two ago where a city waited until they had 1,000 units of multifamily housing in the pipeline and then retroactively imposed a moratorium to freeze 1,000 units of multifamily housing from being built. And some of it was never built. And then providing that for participation in the Met Council's Livable Communities Program, which was established by the legislature again in 1995, in order for a property to count it towards the Met Council's, the legislative requirement that each city participating in the program accept its fair share of affordable housing, in order for land to qualify as meeting towards that goal, it would have to be both guided in the comp plan and zoned for multifamily housing. Many cities are guiding land for affordable housing to get into the Livable Communities Program and then not following through with the zoning. Article 4 is also a big part of it. It addresses, imposes some limitations on on zoning. So there's one provision that prohibits cities from banning modular apartment construction. There's already a provision in state law that says they cannot, cities may not ban modular single family housing construction, but for some reason when that statute was crafted, modular apartment buildings, which are manufactured in Minnesota, being deployed widely now in both the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota, this would bring those types of apartment buildings under the law as well. And then this is a very controversial provision, apparently, but it does allow, require cities to allow duplexes and accessory dwelling units. But I want to stress this, because a lot of the commentary I'm getting is to the contrary. You still have to observe all existing zoning performance standards applicable to single-family homes, including provisions like setbacks, impervious surface coverage, anything that is related to the actual public health, safety, and welfare. But I don't want to make these exceptions so wide you can drive a truck through them. In California, where a law like this was passed, cities, in order to evade these requirements, increased their off-street parking requirements, increased their setback requirements. City of Woodside, California, made the national news by declaring the whole city a mountain lion sanctuary. So, many cities, I think Egan, Bloomington has always allowed duplexes as a permitted use in the city. It has for about a decade allowed accessory dwelling units. And so they're scattered randomly around the city. It's not like the whole city becomes duplexes or homes with ADUs. But as one of the testifiers mentioned, that even if it's one out of 10 lots, home sites, it's still enough that in the aggregate, it could have a significant impact on the supply of affordable housing units in the region. There's a provision that says, going back to Mr. First's testimony, is that planned unit developments would not be, cities would not be able to unilaterally require a PUD if the developer is bringing forward a proposed development that is consistent with the basic comp plan and zoning already. If a developer is bringing forward a development that is consistent with the comp plan, consistent with the zoning, they ought to be able to have that application processed in accordance with their own zoning laws, rather than being forced to go through the PUD process, which is expensive, uncertain, and arbitrary. But I want to be clear, and because there's been a lot of commentary to the contrary, there is nothing in this bill that would prevent a city from voluntarily entering into a planned unit development agreement. So, for example, for a large planned community like, say, the Umore Park in Rosemount, and a case like that where the University of Minnesota is negotiating with the city of Rosemount to do a very large development, I think using the planned unit development process for something like that is probably very, very warranted and appropriate because it is going to be a very unique development. There's a provision that it says, cities cannot, mandate that you choose from a list of expensive exterior building materials. We are seeing requirements mostly in planned unit developments where a city as part of the PUD agreement is saying, if you're going to build a home in this development, you have to face it with a stone, brick, or hardy plank. I'm sorry, but that's just not appropriate. And then finally,
Representative, are you almost?
Yeah, we're almost done. These are the key things. I'm going to skip over some of these later ones, but there is a provision again that minimum square footages or minimum numbers of parking slots may not be required for homes and garages. If you go out and look at these $750,000 homes that are being built out in the developing suburbs right now, and you drive through those neighborhoods, you'll see that every single house has got to have a three-car garage on it. And being required by the city as part of a minimum slots or a minimum garage square footage requirement, and not everybody needs a three-car garage. So this one is important as well. So another abuse that we're seeing is in the area of dedication fees. because cities are not allowed to collect development impact fees. In many cases, cities are resorting to overloading some of the dedication fees that are allowed in state law. So we're seeing park dedication fees that are way in excess of the 10% that is long been customary in the Twin Cities. The bill provision provides that the park dedication fee can be paid in cash, land, or park facilities to be negotiated between the developer and the city. And it clarifies that undevelopable wetlands don't count towards that 10%. It requires that arterial street right-of-way dedications may not exceed the amount of land required under MnDOT state aid guidelines. And for local residential streets that are not governed by the state aid guidelines, it limits the amount of dedication that's required to that needed to build a 32-foot wide street, plus the associated sidewalks and utilities. And typically, this would probably be about 56 feet of total right-of-way. So we're not saying, 32 feet of right-of-way. It's enough right-of-way to build a 32-foot wide street, plus all of the utilities and sidewalks. So in the state aid guidelines, there is it says that for a 36 foot wide, collector type street, the associated amount of right of way should be about 60 feet. So that's why I'm guessing that in most cases, a city would want 56 feet of right of way to build a 32 foot wide street and its utilities. And the reason for this is that, that it's the pavement width itself that drives excess cost. And building local residential streets to wider than 32 feet actually detracts from safety. And then this is another part that has been, widely, misdescribed. So in Article 6, in the metro region and then the metro region only, and only land that is becoming available for residential development for the first time, so nothing does not affect anything in an established residential neighborhood, cities have allowed housing developers to build lots on lots as small of an eighth of an acre if they see a market for that kind of housing. There is nothing in here that says there is an 8-unit per acre target for new residential development. It just means that if a developer sees a market for homes on the same size lots that are common throughout the Minneapolis, St. Paul itself and all of their first ring suburbs, they ought to be able to build such a house by right without having to go through the plan unit development process. And most of the region's existing starter home housing stock consists of smaller homes on these smaller lots in the inner ring suburbs and in the cities. This is, as a chair, I'm going to skip this one for now. Not that many people would understand. It would take too much time. And we don't really need to go through these right now. The slides will be available if you want to peruse these, ask me questions. So this conversation is going to continue. I since first introducing this bill back in July, I have been, continuously meeting with all of the stakeholder groups. The bill has evolved considerably, and it will evolve considerably more before we, actually bring this back for a vote. And the issue in particular that I'm working with the stakeholders on is the order of what I would say called the staged and orderly nature of development. How do we address explicitly in state law, which is not done now, how we have to coordinate the staging of the infrastructure and the housing together. So with that, Madam Chair, sorry we've taken so long, but we can proceed from there.
Okay. Representative Quam, do you want to do your question now, or will it wait till after the I'd like to get to the testifiers.
Madam Chair, I noticed that the author said he was going to be tabling the bill. I just want to make sure I heard correctly. Plus, yes, I was hoping we'd be able to get the rest of the testifiers that showed up and possibly a little bit of time to ask the author on some details. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. McClellan. If you would identify yourself, please, and proceed.
Morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm the state building official and director of construction codes and licensing for the Department of Labor and Industry. My comments will be brief and limited to Article 9, permit fees, and 11, annual report, both of House File 3256. First, and briefly regarding the annual report in Article 11, the department has no concern in raising the reporting exemption from $5,000 to $7,000. Second, regarding permit fees, both permit fees and the annual report were the subject of a technical advisory group formed this fall by the Construction Codes Advisory Council. This TAG reviewed several topics, including draft language on how building officials should calculate permit fees. Currently, building permits are determined by assessing the valuation of new building construction, additions or remodeling, and then applying that valuation to the municipality's fee schedule. Although there was not universal agreement in the TAG on the need to change the current method of how permit fees are calculated, the least controversial option discussed was the method in Article 9, which establishes a uniform way of valuating new residential construction. And there are several benefits to this approach. First, valuation determinations would be uniform statewide, therefore eliminating the subjective valuation process by each municipality. Second, municipalities retain control over the actual fee schedule and cost of permits to ensure they can cover their expenses. Third, transparency is increased as the only variables now are the size of the building and the municipality's fee schedule. And then lastly, the actual valuation formula and other specifics would be included in the state building code as developed through a technical advisory group of affected stakeholders. Thank you very much, and I'll remain available to answer your questions. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair, you're muted.
Thank you. Ms. Backus, if you would identify yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus. I'm with the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, here representing that group as well as 30 other statewide organizations opposed to the authorization of municipal street improvement districts in Article 2 of the bill. Our diverse coalition is listed on a handout in your packets and includes both trade associations and nonprofits representing many sectors of the economy. I just want to hit on a couple of points not highlighted in the handout. Number one is the fact that this provision is included in a bill being called the Legalize Affordable Housing Act, and that only reinforces our collective concern that Article 2 is about shifting the cost of local infrastructure projects from the residential property tax base to business and tax-exempt properties within a municipality. The language in Article 2 grants cities broad authority to draw the districts however they want. There is no requirement that property owners benefit from the improvements or even be in the vicinity of them. Districts could be gerrymandered to include commercial and industrial properties to spare residential properties from paying the fees. Or they could be drawn to capture revenues exclusively from campuses of tax-exempt properties like hospitals, colleges, and religious institutions. It would be much more politically palatable for cities to do this instead of raise property taxes. And with all due respect to Representative Elkins and his slides describing the provision, we dispute that the fee can only be used for redevelopment. Ongoing city street maintenance can be paid for with the fee and has been the major reason cities have championed this concept in the past. Nor do vehicle counts directly link to the type of projects that can be paid for. As you can see on lines 4.12 to 4.18, the proceeds can also be used to pay for sewers, utility connections, fences, trails, and pathways, which aren't related to vehicle use. I also cannot locate any language in the bill requiring that unused funds collected be refunded, but even if that requirement were included, it would not negate our overall opposition to the premise of the bill. And lastly, I just want to say this is absolutely the wrong time to be creating a new tax to levy on business properties. COVID turned our economy upside down, and a number of industries are still in a fragile predicament. Can you imagine being an independent restaurant owner who has weathered this storm, but has now assessed this new tax while a restaurant a few blocks over is not? Or what about an office building that is sat dark while employees work remotely, but is now charged a hefty tax based on vehicle trips that are not occurring? This new tax only exacerbates the economic uncertainty several of our coalition members are facing and creates an unlevel playing field that puts businesses at a competitive disadvantage while they are still in recovery mode. For those reasons, we'd ask you to remove this provision from the bill, and I thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, you're still muted.
Mr. Roberts, if you would identify yourself, please, and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ethan Roberts, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas, the JCRC. And I am here both testifying on behalf of the JCRC. I also have permission to testify on behalf of Shalom, which is a skilled nursing facility and provides other options for seniors. But in a way, I feel like I'm testifying on behalf of all of the tax-exempt properties who are part of our coalition. Echoing what Amber said, it's not just a policy difference that we have about this provision of, you know, creating these districts versus what exists. There's a legal issue here. I don't think anyone disputes that Article 10 of Minnesota State Constitution lays out several types of properties which are tax exempt. And I will note that Representative Elkins' bill does tease out one of them, institutions of purely public charity, which is far more complicated than simply being a nonprofit, to be exempted from this bill. But it leaves everyone else in. So it leaves houses of worship, it leaves hospitals in, it leaves educational institutions, public burial grounds, et cetera. And this is something that is just not disputed, right? There cannot be property taxes levied against us. However, almost as old as that truth is the fact that we can, a municipality can assess special assessments, right? This goes back to the 19th century, and that's completely fair. And the reason for this is not because with a special assessment, taxes and properties are located within the district in which work is going to be done. It's because the municipality must make a good faith effort. And I really recommend that members of the committee actually go to the League of Cities website. They have an excellent toolkit. It's really helpful for municipalities on levying special assessments. Okay. And so they understand they need to prove, they need to show some nexus between the work that's to be done and a special benefit, which is a term of art, to the property owner. That is, that the property owner's property will increase in value in an amount that's greater than the amount of money to be assessed. This is what's required by law to assess what are essentially taxes on tax-exempt properties. It's also actually required for non-tax-exempt properties. Representative Elkins' bill has no such provision that a special benefit be proven or demonstrated, as Amber previously testified. And so essentially what is going to happen in the real world is that if given this authority, if given this power, municipalities will levy what is essentially a tax. And I'm not sure if anyone wants to claim this is a fee. I would caution against that. I think that the Supreme Court decision from 2016 is very clear that this is a tax. I think Representative Elkins' comments are clear that this is a tax. So essentially, you could levy a tax, and then what's going to happen? What's going to happen is that we're going to have to sue. And that's unfair, because likely the litigation costs could easily outweigh what's being assessed against us. So in the real world, where not every property owner has access to crackerjack pro bono counsel or unlimited resources, we're going to be given an impossible choice. Either we just pay something that constitutionally we shouldn't have to pay, or we sue to basically, you know, affirm our, you know, what is essentially our legal rights. And so this is why it's important for the legislature not to rely upon the judicial system to exercise your judgment, your wisdom, and honestly, your authority to prevent what is essentially an unconstitutional scheme to move forward. I understand that Representative Elkins intends to lay his bill over, be happy to work with him, be happy to work with the League of Cities, but, you know, essentially, if we don't have the special benefit provision, this bill just can't move forward against tax-exempt properties. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Mr. Worshe, and we do have, we'll be able to go over for about five minutes or so. So again, I'd like to get everybody done today. Mr. Worshe, if you would identify yourself and proceed.
Certainly, thank you. My name is David Worshe. I'm the CEO of Worshe Homes. We're a design build company in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I'm also a board member of our Central Minnesota Builders Association and past president. I usually kind of get on these and I wing it on the topics, but I know we're pressed for time, so I typed it out and I'm just going to read through it. Thanks for the opportunity to share a home builder's perspective on the important legislation. If we want homes that people can afford, we need to stop talking and start acting. This bill is an important step in the right direction. Here in central Minnesota, we've had many community discussions about labor force needs and workforce housing. Homes that workers can afford are essential to keeping and attracting the workers we need. Home building is at the tip of the economics spear as we recover from the pandemic, and we need this bill to help developers and home builders build what is needed at a reasonable price point. There are thousands of homes, we are thousands of homes behind in Minnesota, as we've already heard. We have to stop piling it on. A huge part of our cost of home building is the fees and regulatory burdens. This bill ends mandated luxury material upgrades and building code conflicts that just add to the cost of building homes. Within general guidelines, let the homeowner and the builder decide what they want and what they can afford. PUDs, or PUDs, as we've heard today, should be a tool or an option when mutually agreed upon, not used as a default standard for zoning. I appreciate that this bill leaves open the option, but ends zoning by loophole, which adds cost and complexity to every housing development. I look at PUDs as an analogy between a production home builder who builds the same three homes over and over again versus a custom home builder like myself, where every home starts from scratch and there's a lot of time put into the design and all the details within the home. The production builder is more like somebody who's developing land and following the ordinance and the zoning. A custom home builder says, we're going to do something a little different, similar to a PUD. We're going to do something outside of what the zoning is. And that's completely okay, but it needs to be an option because a custom home costs a lot more than a production home. There's more time involved. There's more people involved. There's more expense involved. And therefore, the same thing is true with PUDs. They are more expensive than just following the zoning that the city has laid out. For the record, we do not like Articles 1 and 2 on the bill, which would add thousands of dollars to the cost of each new home and take us backward in terms of affordability. Increasing housing affordability and access to homeownership requires a sustained surge of new homes of all types, especially those priced modestly and targeted toward first-time homebuyers. HF 3256 takes a regional approach to housing and returns affordability and access into the housing market equation. Thank you again for your time and attention to this important legislation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, you're muted again.
Mr. Hoyer, please identify yourself.
Good morning. This is Paul Hoyer with Pulte Group. I work for Pulte Group, and we build under three name brands for homes in the Twin Cities area, Pulte Homes, Del Webb, and Centex. A little bit about my background. The first half of my career, I worked for cities. I was a consulting city engineer. And the last half of my career, I've worked as a land developer and a home builder. So I have perhaps a unique perspective in understanding how the different parties have different interests and how they make decisions and why. Danielle did a great job on the update on the current market for housing. I just want to reiterate one thing, and that is we are seeing a lot of strong demand for first-time home buyers, particularly for detached single-family homes that we're really unable to satisfy. You know, the evidence is pretty obvious out there with the existing for sale, resale market being on fire. The fact that we get a lot of feedback from our home buyers saying they'd like to buy a single family home. And also we're selling a lot of townhomes right now, attached townhomes, because that's what people are able to afford a little bit easier than a single family home. So we're just not able to really hit that part of the market, the single family first time home buyer that we're really looking to serve. On the issue of housing affordability, I've been really curious and interested in this topic for the last 20 years. I've been researching it, studying it. I've watched over the last five decades how we've seen our increase of housing on a yearly basis exceed the increase in our incomes. And this trend is obviously very damaging and made me very curious. So I've been really studying this issue in depth for the last 20 years, as I said. The decrease in affordability has really been verified and actually kind of shown it from a mathematical perspective in different markets across the world. And in the Twin Cities, we have definitely seen a decrease in affordability over the last few decades, pretty steadily. Why is one of the questions. You know, obviously this is a very damaging thing, not just for individuals who can't afford homes, but also for our regional market. It's just not healthy. And my conclusion is that the accumulating regulations that we've seen over the last 30 to 40 years has played a big part in it. It's complex. There are a lot of causes to this, but definitely the increase in regulations have been a major contributor to that. As a home builder, we'd like to serve the first-time home buyer a lot better than we can at the current time. We welcome any changes that could help us get more to that point. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Coyle, if you would identify yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Nice to see you again. Members of the committee, my name is Peter Coyle, 8300 Norman Center Drive, Bloomington, Minnesota. I'm a lawyer lobbyist representing Housing First Minnesota in this hearing. I want to start by thanking Representative Elkins for starting a very important topic of discussion for Minnesota. It's critically important to families that want to live and work in Minnesota. And housing affordability is approaching crisis proportions for young families, for individuals, empty nesters, all of whom want to maintain their residency within Minnesota. And we see around the country that other housing companies are able to meet the market for lower cost, durable, affordable housing. And yet for some reason, Minnesota's regulatory environment does not allow that to occur. This bill is an important step in that conversation. Madam Chair, in my law practice, I represent builders and developers across the state of Minnesota, including in the city of Eagan, as you know. I've reviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of development agreements that impose all kinds of mandates on new housing construction. Some of them are appropriate in the sense of park locations or street infrastructure, but a growing number of them are not. And at the end of the day, they all make housing more expensive and difficult to achieve in the state of Minnesota. On the topic of the transportation fees, I'll simply say this. We oppose any provision that will make housing more expensive in Minnesota. Having said that, Representative Elkins' bill introduces topics that need to be discussed. We understand that transportation infrastructure in particular is expensive, and I will tell you that every client I've ever represented in a city pays its share of that cost and will continue to do so. But what we do object to is the piling on that occurs in the development process, particularly through the use of PUDs, as others have spoken to. I'll speak very briefly, Madam Chair, to the bill. Others have covered many of these topics. I don't want to be redundant to that. Suffice to say, though, that at the end of this process, the goal needs to be that the state of Minnesota supports policies that will drive down the cost of new housing construction and make sure that more housing is more affordable to more people who want to live in Minnesota. With regard to the topic of local control, which is the primary objection being raised by communities to Representative Elkins' bill or bills like this, I'll remind the committee that the primary planning statutes in Minnesota, Chapter 394 and Chapter 462, are grants of authority by the legislature to cities. Without that authority, cities do not have any authority, period. It's entirely appropriate for the legislature to be involved in this conversation and to assert its role to try to ensure that Minnesota's housing policies are achieving the needs of Minnesota citizens who want and need a place to live. With regard to the topic of planned unit developments, I've seen this process become a runaway train. It's increasingly used to force what I think are unlawful conditions on new development, with the consequence that too much land is being taken out of production, too many fees are being added to the cost of housing production, and too many conditions are being imposed that make new housing more expensive than it should be. I think Representative Elkin's bill strikes the right balance by preserving builder choice, but also recognizing that cities still get to set the terms of their zoning ordinance in order to provide more predictability and certainty as to the type of product that will be allowed and then ultimately the cost of that product. So we certainly support that provision. With regard to dedications, developers and builders acknowledge the need for park systems, and we support that and have always supported that. However, we've seen cities apply inconsistent practices toward park dedication, and in particular, we've seen them apply wholly inconsistent fee policies that are in violation of statute, in my opinion. We need to provide order to that and try to bring that practice to an end. Madam Chair, I can see you want to shut me down, so I will jump to the end. This bill is an important policy discussion. We need to continue it. I encourage the legislature to take positive action to help us reset the market, to signal to builders across the country that Minnesota is open. We want to see new housing built, and we want to see it be as affordable as it can be while maintaining our high standards for energy efficiency and durability. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Mr. Eager, I can give you 2 minutes. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Eager, and I am Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Representative Elkin's House File 3256. And I want to thank Representative Elkins for being so generous with his time over the last several months and his willingness to engage in conversations about the bill. We support Representative Elkins' efforts through House File 3256 to increase the supply of housing, and particularly housing that is broadly affordable to more Minnesotans. However, there are also a few items in the bill which we oppose, and I'll touch briefly on those in my testimony. You've heard a lot of data this morning, but I just want to touch on a couple of data points from our statewide market data report. And just to frame this up, the inventory of homes continues to be a serious and chronic challenge for buyers and the overall health of our housing market. Minnesota Realtors data in January found only 6,600 homes for sale statewide, and that's a 24% reduction compared to January 2021. The number of homes for sale this January is less than a one-month supply of inventory, which is dramatically short of the 4 to 6 months that would characterize a healthy market. Looking back to December 2012, there were over 36,000 homes for sale statewide. When buyers compete for scarce inventory, we see the impact on a variety of metrics. Days on the market, pending sales, and closed sales were all down double digits in January, and median sales price, not surprisingly, was up 8.5%. This lack of housing inventory is definitely holding the market back and posing a significant challenge to getting more Minnesotans into home ownership. We'll continue to do so until creative and market-driven responses to meet that demand are implemented. House File 3256 advances an important discussion about how Minnesota can remove barriers to building more housing and create more housing opportunities to meet existing and future demand, particularly at the most affordable price points. And while this is a comprehensive bill and we support many provisions in it, there are also a few items we oppose. Articles 1 and 2.
Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to close. I appreciate your participation, and thank you, everyone. We do have to adjourn. Again, have a good day, and thank you again for all of your interest and participation.